June 14th, 1919. Before Lindbergh, before Earhart, before the world had even decided whether transatlantic flight was something human beings could survive, two men in an open cockpit, a modified World War I bomber, and an Irish bog waiting for them on the other side. I'm Taildragger, and this is The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Pull up a chair. We've got a good one today. Before we get into it, a word from today's sponsor. This show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. These aren't trinkets. They're the kind of thing you set on a shelf and look at years later and remember exactly what that morning felt like. AviationSoul.com. Every coin tells a story. All right, let's go back. Most people think Charles Lindbergh flew the first transatlantic crossing, and in fairness to Lindbergh, he flew the first solo nonstop transatlantic. That distinction matters, and it's a record that deserves every bit of its fame. But 8 years before Lindbergh climbed into the Spirit of St. Louis, two Englishmen flew an open cockpit bomber across the North Atlantic in 16 hours and 27 minutes. And history decided not to put their names on the same pedestal. That's a wrong worth correcting. John Alcock was 26 years old. A Royal Naval Air Service pilot who had been shot down and taken prisoner in the First World War after the armistice. He came home to a country that had thousands of trained aviators and not nearly enough airplanes to put them in. He was hungry, the way you're hungry when war has used up the best years of your youth and then handed you a demobilization paper and told you to figure out the rest. Arthur Witten Brown was 32, a navigator, also former Royal Flying Corps, also a prisoner of war. He'd been shot down over Germany, spent time in a camp, came home walking with a limp from a leg wound that never healed quite right. Brown was the quieter one, the methodical one, the man who would prove in the hours ahead that calm competence is its own kind of heroism. Now here's where it gets interesting. In 1913, the Daily Mail newspaper offered a prize of £10,000 sterling to the first aviator who could fly nonstop across the Atlantic in under 72 hours. The war interrupted everything. The prize sat unclaimed. But in 1919, it was back on the table, and that £10,000 translated to something like $500,000 in today's money. More than enough to attract serious competitors. Alcock and Brown were just one team among many. Harry Hawker and Kenneth Mackenzie Grieve had already attempted it in May and ditched in the ocean. They were rescued, lucky to be alive. The Handley Page V1500 team was preparing a larger aircraft. An American Curtis flying boat, the Navy Curtis IV, was already partway across on a multi-leg route with stops in the Azores. It made the crossing that way, in May of 1919. But the Daily Mail prize specifically required a non-stop crossing, point to point. Alcock and Brown were working with the Vickers Company. Their aircraft was the Vickers Vimy, a twin-engine heavy bomber built late in the war. Big biplane, open cockpit, side by side, powered by two Rolls-Royce Eagle engines, each producing around 360 horsepower at a time when that was extraordinary. The wingspan was 68 feet. The fuselage smelled of doped fabric and engine oil, and the particular kind of grease that soaks into wooden structures over long flights. They knew that smell. They'd both been around enough aeroplanes by then that it was just the smell of work. The modified Vimy carried no guns, obviously. Where the bomb bay had been, they put a fuel tank. Extra tanks were added in the forward fuselage, total fuel load roughly 865 gallons. The aircraft full of fuel weighed around 13,000 pounds. Getting that into the air from a short, rough field in Newfoundland was its own adventure. They chose St. John's, Newfoundland as their departure point because it was the closest piece of North America to Europe. They'd been waiting in St. John's for 3 weeks. 3 weeks of fog, storms, and frustration, watching the weather window that never quite opened. The Handley Page team was setting up nearby, and they knew the clock was ticking. On the morning of June 14th, the weather looked like it might cooperate, might. Their meteorologist, whose name was Fitzgerald, told them the forecast was acceptable, which in 1919 meteorology meant approximately nobody sure, but probably not terrible. They took it. The takeoff run used virtually the entire length of their rough, improvised strip. The Vimy staggered into the air heavy with fuel, cleared the trees at the field boundary with perhaps 20 feet to spare. And Alcock turned east. The first hours were surprisingly smooth. They climbed to around 6,000 feet and settled in. Brown worked his navigation tables, shot sunsights when he could, calculated their position. The engines ran well. The Rolls-Royce Eagles had a deep industrial thunder to them. Not like a fighter engine scream, more like something that means to keep working all day and all night regardless of what you think about it. Then the trouble started. About an hour into the flight, their radio generator failed. The small windmill-driven generator that powered their wireless set broke off. They were now across the point of no useful return, heading east, with no way to communicate with anyone. No radio contact, no position reports. If something went wrong, nobody would know where to look until they were very, very overdue. The weather deteriorated. They flew into cloud, thick, gray, disorienting cloud that wrapped around the open cockpits and soaked everything. At altitude, the temperature dropped to 30 below zero Fahrenheit. They were dressed for it, leather flying suits, helmets, goggles, but there is dress for it and there is ready for it, and those are not always the same thing. Ice began to build on the aircraft. Not the thin rime ice that modern pilots talk about as an inconvenience, but serious structural ice, the kind that adds weight and kills lift and clogs intake scoops. Brown could see it forming on the leading edges of the wings. He could see it starting to affect the engines. The Vimy's engines had intake scoops that were vulnerable to icing. If those scoops clogged, the engines would lose power and eventually stop. Brown understood this, and Brown did something that is almost impossible to imagine today. He climbed out of the cockpit. In flight. At altitude. In icing conditions. Brown crawled out onto the lower wing of the Vimy, steadied himself against the wire bracing and struts, and manually chipped ice away from the engine intakes with a knife. The wind at their cruise speed of around 100 miles per hour was trying to tear him off the aircraft. His bad leg made every movement harder. He did this not once. He did it 6 times during the flight. Let me say that again. 6 times Arthur Witten Brown left his cockpit, crawled out onto the wing of a moving aircraft in freezing cloud, and worked with his hands to keep the engines running. Every time he went back to his seat, he resumed his navigation as if nothing remarkable had happened, as if that was just part of the job. Alcock had his own problem to manage. The aircraft had no horizon. No gyroscopic attitude instruments the way we'd think of them. They were flying through cloud, through night, with nothing but a basic turn and bank indicator and his own instincts. And at one point, those instincts failed him. The Vimy entered a spiral dive. What happened was this. They hit a particularly thick, disorienting bank of cloud and lost all sense of attitude. Alcock, flying on feel, and the basic instruments he had, didn't catch the bank developing before it turned into a spiral. By the time he realized what was happening, the aircraft was in a near-vertical bank, nose down, and they were unwinding toward the ocean fast. The altimeter was spinning backwards, the airspeed was building into the dangerous range. The engines, running at a power setting meant for cruise, were winding up in the dive. The ocean was somewhere below them, and the cloud showed no sign of breaking. It broke at 50 feet. Alcock found the horizon with 50 feet between the bottom of the Vimy and the North Atlantic. He leveled the wings, he pulled the nose up before the attitude of the dive transferred into an overspeed or a structural failure. The ocean was right there, dark and cold, and then they were climbing again. Neither man discussed it in detail afterward. There wasn't much to say. It happened, and they were still flying. They had snow. They had sleet. They had episodes of clear air at dawn where Brown could shoot a star sight and calculate their position, and he found they were reasonably close to where he'd predicted they should be. The navigation across an ocean with no landmarks, no radio, in moving weather, using dead reckoning and celestial observations from an open cockpit at altitude, was itself a feat that doesn't get enough acknowledgement. They crossed the Irish coast over Clifton, County Galway, at around 8:15 in the morning local time on June 15th. They'd been airborne for 16 hours and 27 minutes. They needed to land. Alcock spotted what looked like a perfect green field below. Smooth, level, green. He set up the approach. It was a bog. The Vickers Vimy's main wheels hit the surface and immediately sank. The aircraft pitched forward, nose down into the peat, and came to rest with the tail up in the air. Alcock and Brown were unhurt. The aircraft, which had just crossed the Atlantic Ocean, was nose down in an Irish bog that looked exactly like a landing field from 200 feet. Some soldiers from a nearby wireless station ran over to help. Brown reportedly looked around at the soft peat at the upended aircraft and said something to the effect that he'd rather have landed in a proper field, which was, for a man who had just crawled onto a wing 6 times at altitude in icing conditions, probably the understatement of the decade, they'd done it. First non-stop transatlantic crossing, 1,890 miles, give or take. Open cockpit, dead reckoning. Ice and fog and a spiral dive that nearly ended everything 50 feet above the Atlantic. The Daily Mail gave them the 10,000 pounds. King George V knighted both of them within days of the landing. They were heroes in the proper sense, which means they had done something genuinely hard and genuinely first and genuinely dangerous. And then, 6 months later, John Alcock was dead.
He was killed in a flying accident in December of 1919,
delivering a new Vickers Viking amphibian to an air show in Paris. He flew into fog, hit a hill in Normandy, and didn't walk away. He was 27 years old. The same age that killed so many pilots in that era, when the aircraft were pushing the edges of what anyone understood and the weather had no mercy for the ones who flew into it without enough respect. Brown lived until 1948. He never flew again after Alcock's death. He worked for Vickers in a management role, married, had a son who was killed in the Second World War. He was quiet about the crossing in his later years, the way men of that generation sometimes went quiet about the things they'd done. He died in his sleep, which, given what he'd survived, seems like he'd more than earned. Lindbergh got the ticker tape parade and the name recognition. Lindbergh deserved it, to be clear. 33.5 hours alone across the Atlantic in 1927, with only a periscope to see forward because the fuel tank blocked the view through the windshield, with sleep deprivation pushing him toward hallucinations, is a remarkable feat. I'm not taking anything away from it. But Alcock and Brown went first. In a heavier aircraft, with less reliable instruments in open cockpits, in worse weather, with a navigator who physically got out of the airplane 6 times to keep it flying. Back when Avigas was cheap and airspace was free, the old-timers would have known these names the same way they knew Lindbergh's. Somewhere along the way, we let them slip. Seems worth the 16 hours it took them to remind ourselves. Sources for today include the Royal Aeronautical Society records, Peter Rees's book Alcock and Brown, First to Fly the Atlantic, and the Vickers Archives as cited in various historical surveys. Find us at radiohanger.com. I'm Taildragger. See you next time.